The United States Army Air Force is off for Berlin.
Ready for war, sir. Ready for war.
The magnificence of the courage and fortitude of the Korean people defies description.
Other battles were raging in the streets of Saigon.
We today have concluded an agreement to end the war and bring peace with honor in Vietnam.
There has been unusual American air activity in the area of the Persian Gulf.
We are determined to knock out Saddam Hussein's nuclear bomb potential.
Afghanistan is a war that we had to fight and we have to win.
This is Veterans Chronicles. For the next hour, join our honored roster of heroic soldiers, sailors, and aviators, recalling and retelling their personal stories. From World War II,
this, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War,
to the present day.
In Afghanistan and Iraq, 50 million people are now living in freedom.
Now, the American Veterans Center and Radio America present Veterans Chronicles.
Our guest this week on Veterans Chronicles is Sergeant Ryan Pitts of the U.S. Army. He's a veteran of the war in Afghanistan, and he's also recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. And Ryan, it's good to have you with us.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
We're here at the annual American Veterans Center Conference, and let's just start at the very beginning of your story. Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Lowell, Massachusetts, but kind of grew up all over New England.
Okay. And when did you join the service?
I joined in my senior year of high school in 2003.
And why?
Honestly, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't know what I wanted to do. Parents couldn't afford college, or at least not all of it, and it just seemed like it wouldn't be a waste of my time, and I had always kind of wanted to serve my country.
And you knew obviously you'd have a pretty good chance of being in combat at that point, right?
You know what? I was naive then. I kind of thought, you know, hey, this is America. We'll roll in. This will be over quick. I didn't think, I wasn't against going if that was going to be, but I just assumed it kind of be over before I got there.
Wow. So where did you get sent for training and so forth?
I went to Fort Sill, Oklahoma for basic and then my actual individual job training, and airborne school at Fort Benning, Georgia, and then on to my final unit, which was the 173rd Airborne Brigade in Italy.
Talk about airborne school. What was that like?
It was fun. Yeah, I mean, it wasn't as hard as everybody made it sound like it was going to be crazy hard. And I mean, it was challenging, but it wasn't that hard. It was, you know, a lot of running. I'd never jumped out of a plane before at that time, but they do such a good job of training you and making it kind of like muscle memory. By the time you get up there, you know, that green light comes on and you're just thinking, I gotta go out the door. That's what we've been doing. I just walk to the door and turn and jump. And so it was a lot of fun.
How do they train you before you go up there to be ready for that?
There's like a ground week, there's a tower week where you practice exiting like a mock tower. You're on like these zip lines and practice holding the position, and then the last week you jump out of a plane. So by the time you get there, you've kind of done like all the steps except actually exit a real aircraft with a parachute. And it really was. I mean, I was just following the guy in front of me, turn, jump out the door, and then all of a sudden you're like, oh, wow, I'm outside. This is, I better listen to the rest of the instructions.
Is it just you or do you have an instructor with you?
So there's instructors in the aircraft, the jump masters and the safeties, but it's you and whoever else is exiting the aircraft. It's all static line, so your parachute's hooked up to a cable inside, and as you leave, it pulls your chute.
Okay. But so that sounds like there wasn't much stress or anxiety given your preparation, but when it's real, is it a little bit different?
You know, it's excitement.
That first moment?
And the first one, I mean, yeah, there's that unknown. After that, you kind of fall relatively quickly. It's more like controlled falling. And you hit the ground kind of hard. And so afterwards, it's not the jumping out of the plane that bothers you. It's the landing.
How do you prepare for that? What do they teach you?
I teach you to keep your feet and knees together, bend your legs a little bit, keep your eyes on the horizon, and just kind of, you know, roll with it. And but the big one is just keep your feet and knees together.
Any chute issues along the way, or was it?
I've never had any chute issues, no.
And how long does that school last?
That school's 3 weeks.
Okay. And then you, as you said, you got attached to the 173rd.
Yep.
And what did you do with them before you deployed to Afghanistan?
Well, I mean, the whole year, I was there about a year before we deployed, and that was just all training. And my job specifically, I was a forward observer in an infantry company. And so a lot of it was learning my job, going to simulators and practices doing our job, or we'd go to Germany is where we train a lot, and go up and do live fire exercises and call real artillery missions and practice, you know, our war games, you know, pre-deployment exercises to get ready to go.
Are you doing any air jumping at this point?
Yeah, we did some jumping. I mean, at that point in time, there were a lot of aircraft being used to move supplies to Afghanistan and Iraq. And once you're on jump status, you go to an actual airborne unit, you just have to do 4 jumps a year to stay on jump status. So I just made 4 jumps that year.
When was your first deployment to Afghanistan?
My first deployment to Afghanistan was in 2005, 2006.
And what was their mission? Where were you?
We were down south. Our battalion was stationed at in Zabul province in a village called Kalat, and our brigade had kind of the southern part of the country. And our mission there was to support the local government and, you know, deny the enemy freedom of movement and do whatever it takes to, you know, win.
How active was the enemy down there?
At that point in time, they were starting to get more active. You know, the focus had kind of, you know, as I understood it, kind of had shifted to Iraq at that point. And so there was a lot more troops there, a lot more emphasis on that. And so there was kind of almost like a resurgence that occurred. And we were pretty busy the first few months that we were there. It slowed down in the winter, and then we were kind of out of there before the fighting season picked up the next year.
What was your first contact with the enemy like?
I mean, first contact with the enemy, I really wasn't prepared for it. I mean, I guess you really never are. We had a unit that was out doing a mission, one of our scout units, so a relatively small unit, and they had come under attack by a pretty sizable enemy force. And our job was to load up on helicopters and fly out there. And so we were flying into they were telling us it was going to be a hot LZ. So we, you know, could be running off the back of the helicopters into gunfire. And I don't know. You can't explain it. It was surreal.
So what did you do?
Oh, we hit the ground and started clearing. We were in this, it was the Argandab River Valley. And just started clearing through like this grove, eventually, you know, came into contact with the enemy. There was multiple elements maneuvering, and I mean, we had taken some casualties that day, but luckily we didn't have anyone killed in action, and we had decisively defeated the enemy there.
Was this Taliban, or was this a different?
They were anti-Afghan, anti-American forces.
That's all it really took.
I'd classify them.
Okay.
And how frequent? You said they were starting to become more of a problem. So how frequent would you be engaging with them at that point?
I mean, I think we were in a large engagement, and by large, I mean probably 30 or more enemy fighters. You know, we were in one large engagement a month from May to July. So, I mean, kind of through that fighting season, we saw a lot. And then, it tapered off in the wintertime just as it got cold. They just weren't as active.
Mm-hmm. What was it like dealing with the locals?
You know, I mean, it's different. It's a different lifestyle over there. I mean, it really was, it was like going back in time, because you'd go out to some places where people are living in mud huts. There's no electricity, and it's, you know, like it was 2,000 years ago, I mean, it felt like. But you know, what an incredibly, you know, tough people living like that. And, you know, we'd be doing missions, and you would see these 8-year-old kids come out of nowhere just herding goats and, you know, what seemed like forever away from a village, all by themselves, you know, just responsible walking out there. And I mean, we had some really good interaction. At that point in time, I remember our company did a lot of work with an Afghan National Police unit down there. Their commander was, his name was Cotter John. And I mean, they were really instrumental in helping us go and try and find the enemy and seek out, you know, missions to execute.
Were they friendly? Were they glad you were there, the locals and the local officials? Were they getting tired of the fact that they didn't just have their own community themselves?
You know, I mean, I didn't engage much with them at that point, just because I was really a private or really, you know, a line guy. But, you know, I think there was always that mix of some that were grateful that we were there and some that were probably apprehensive about, you know, suspicious of our intentions.
How would you describe the caliber of the enemy fighter?
Tenacious. They, you know, there was no doubt that they wanted to kill me and my friends. At that point in time, they weren't as well trained as they were, as I would say, on like my second deployment. You know, they had started to kind of, you know, they learn your tactics. And I mean, it's a dynamic situation, right? The enemy has a say in every fight that you have. So I think, you know, we really had great commanders and we had great men that I served with. You know, all across, I mean, really all the forces that we had served with there were really incredible and did a good job of taking the fight to the enemy and trying to, you know, mitigate whatever sort of advantages they might have, you know, of being able to blend in with the populace, or, you know, they're not moving around with as much heavy gear as we are and things like that.
By the time you left after your first tour there, did you feel like the place was more stable and more secure, or was it just like an ongoing challenge?
I mean, I think between my first and second deployment, I felt like I saw a change, you know, just in the Afghan National Army. I mean, on our first deployment, we would mainly use them after we'd be in a fight, and they would come through and kind of do the battle damage assessment, clear the battlefield, look for casualties, collect enemy equipment, and things like that. By our second deployment, we were actively executing missions with them. We'd go on patrols. Every time we'd go out, there'd be a contingency of them going with us. I also saw there was a lot of effort. I mean, we were in two separate different areas of the country. We were down south for my first deployment, up north in Kunar province of my second. I mean, even over the course of just a deployment, we'd see a change in terms of opening schools and clinics and paving roads. And it wasn't just, you know, us looking for a fight to try and just defeat the enemy, but it was also trying to, you know, build the infrastructure for the people to have better lives.
You believe by the time you left on the second deployment, that do you get the sense that eventually they're going to be ready to handle their own security by themselves?
Oh, yeah, that's the intent. That's the hope.
Sure. What did you do between deployments after you came home from the first one?
After I came home from the deployment, I mean, it was basically the same as the lead up to the first one. At that point in time, it was kind of every unit in our military was either in an active deployment or you were preparing to go. And so it was come back, rest and refit for a short period of time, and then get right back to training. So we went up to Germany a couple of times and did the same sort of live fire exercises, war games, and things like that, and got ready to go for the second deployment.
And where were you? Oh, you already answered that, but how about stateside? Any particular assignments here?
No, I never actually. I served my entire career basically within the same company, the 173rd Airborne Brigade chose a company.
Were you ever injured on the first deployment?
No, I was never injured on my first deployment.
Ryan, we're going to pause for a quick break. We'll be right back on Veterans Chronicles.
Veterans Chronicles is presented by the American Veteran Center, an educational foundation dedicated toward preserving the legacy of America's servicemen and servicewomen of all generations. The center is home to two organizations, the World War II Veterans Committee and the National Vietnam Veterans Committee, each working to tell the stories of their respective veterans. In addition to this program, the American Veterans Center is also the primary sponsor of the National Memorial Day Parade, held annually in Washington, D.C. For more information on the American Veterans Center and its programs, visit the center's website at www.americanveteranscenter.org or call 703-302-1012, 703-302-1012.
You're listening to Veterans Chronicles, presented by the American Veterans Center and the Radio America Network.
We are back on Veterans Chronicles. I'm Greg Corumbus. Thanks for being with us. Honored to be joined today at the American Veterans Center Conference by Sergeant Ryan Pitts, veteran of the U.S. Army, veteran of the war in Afghanistan, two tours that he served there. And Ryan, you're also a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, which those who can see this interview know that you're wearing right now. This is a result of your second deployment. Set the stage for us. What was the mission? What was the deployment as you went the second time?
Yeah, so same sort of mission as the first one. You know, go there, deny the enemy freedom of movement, try and, you know, eliminate any enemy. They're going to try and undermine the government there as we're trying to, you know, make sure Afghanistan can get up and stand on its own, but also to support the people and hopefully try and provide them a better life. And we were in northeastern Afghanistan this time. A little bit different type of terrain than it was the first time. I mean, still mountainous, but it was the valleys were much narrower. Mountains seemed a little bit bigger. And we were there about 13 months prior to the battle. And our final mission, the one that I was on, we were moving to a village to set up security, to construct a new base in order for us to hand it over to the next incoming unit. To set them up for success. We knew that they were going to be coming in with less experienced soldiers, but also fewer numbers than what we had. And given the kind of the amount of contact, we'd had a very kinetic year with the enemy leading up to that, that we wanted to put them in the best position we could to be successful after us. And really, you know, our deployments aren't over until you're, you know, boots on the ground wherever home is.
So this is 2008 now. And you are serving, I'm not sure if I'm saying this right, is it Wanat?
Yep.
Wanat Vehicle Patrol Base. What was your assigned duty there?
My assigned duty, in my platoon, I was the forward observer. So I was tasked with controlling artillery, and if we had attack aviation come in, I would interact with the attack aviation. I was with 9 soldiers at an observation post. We had set up the main post where the majority of our forces were in the center of the village in a vehicle patrol base. We had another position as a traffic control point, and then our 9 soldiers were about 100-150 meters away from the vehicle patrol base, and we were kind of supposed to be just a little bit more eyes and ears out to see a little bit more what was going on.
And then what happened?
On the morning of the fifth day, we were attacked by 150 to 200 plus enemy fighters. There were 49 Americans on the ground, mostly our company, our platoon, I should say. We had some Marine embedded training team guys, some Afghan National Army guys, and some engineers, and the valley just erupted a fire. This was about 4:30 in the morning. We had woken up for stand to. Everybody gets up before the sun comes up in preparation for a potential attack, and we had done that, and around 4:30, it opened up with a burst of machine gun fire from the north, and then just all hell broke loose.
What were they throwing at you?
There was automatic small arms fire, AK fire. There were a lot of RPGs. Our position, in particular, we got hit with some hand grenades as some guys had tried to move in close to our position.
And what was your response?
Our response, I mean, the guys that I was with, and really every position, just immediately returned fire on the enemy. I mean, there was an overwhelming amount of fire coming in. The enemy had us surrounded. They had the element of surprise, obviously, and they had high ground. But, you know, our guys were, I mean, incredible that day. You know, the guys in the gun trucks, I mean, I've seen the pictures after the battle of just bullet marks all over the trucks, and they stayed in the guns for as long as the weapons were functioning. I mean, some of the weapon systems were taken out by enemy fire. All the guys that I was with at my position, some of us were wounded in the opening barrage, but other guys like Jason Bogar and Jonathan Ayers and Matt Phillips, I mean, these guys immediately started returning fire and doing their jobs regardless of what was going on around them.
Despite the chaos, was there like organized command and like organized response?
I mean, it is organized chaos. I mean, at that point, we'd all had assigned positions. Everybody knew what their jobs were to do. So, I mean, in the initial chaos, there wasn't a whole lot of command and control at our position. It was just everybody in their individual fighting positions, returning fire and doing what they were supposed to do. We had our company commander up there at the time, Captain Matt Meyer, and he was helping control the fight from down at the vehicle patrol base. As it went on, I mean, up at the observation post, it was less like any of us giving directives and giving orders as it was just we were all working together as a team. Everybody knew what they had to do. We were in the fight of our lives, and everybody wanted to do whatever they could to bring their brothers home.
Just about a minute before we have to take our break here. At what point were you first wounded?
I was wounded in the open barrage, and there was a number of other guys up at the observation post that were wounded in that opening salvo of rocket-propelled grenades and hand grenades.
And where were you hit?
I was hitting both legs, my left arm, left hip, a little bit my forehead.
And were you still able to stand?
No, I was not able to stand.
How do you keep that mindset when you know what's happening to you?
I mean, honestly, I was shell-shocked when it first happened because I was standing up trying to locate a potential enemy location, and just everything blew up around me, and I got tossed, and I came to and just... was just very disoriented for a couple of minutes.
Ryan, let's pause right there real quickly, and we'll come back to this amazing story on Veterans Chronicles.
World War II.
The German news agency said today in a broadcast that the Allied invasion had begun.
Korea.
The armed invasion of the Republic of Korea by armed forces from Northern Korea constituted a breach of the peace.
Vietnam.
The curfew is in effect for the Saigon, Cholon, Jiaxin area.
The Gulf War.
The skies over Baghdad have been illuminated. Bright flashes going off all over the sky.
A special thanks to veterans everywhere from the Radio America Network.
You are listening to Veterans Chronicles on the Radio America Network. I'm Greg Corumbus, honored to be joined today by Ryan Pitts. He is a recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor and a veteran of two tours in Afghanistan with the U.S. Army Airborne. And Ryan, we're just in the middle of the story where we're talking about how you were first hit, you're hitting the legs, you're still firing back, even though you can't even stand. From what I've read, you then helped to repel the attackers with a pretty ingenious use of grenades. Tell me about what you did there.
I mean, I didn't invent the concept of cooking grenades. I first actually, the first time I had ever seen it done, it was part of our hand grenade qualification course in basic training. And then we only did it with dummy grenades, and it was to take out potential enemy bunkers. But the enemy, we thought that they were in this dead space to the north, so like this little riverbed that we couldn't exactly see down inside. And if they had been throwing hand grenades in, I didn't want them to have the opportunity to pick up the ones that we were throwing at them. So I would, pull the pin on the grenade, let the fuse cook off for a few seconds, and then throw it into the riverbed.
So it was exploding on contact.
I mean, that was the idea. I wasn't sticking my head up to see if that was the case.
How close were they then, if they're in that valley? How far is that from you?
10, 15 yards.
Is that all?
Yep.
And how can you tell what impact it's having? Did you find out then that they were in there?
Honestly, I don't know. I just kept doing it. I threw a bunch of hand grenades in there and then switched to a machine gun to start firing the machine gun. I didn't immediately start returning fire because I was wounded the initial salvo. And, I'm shell-shocked, and I had to get actually treated first before I could ever even join the fight. Jason Bogar actually put a tourniquet on my right leg. And it saved my life. And it was kind of sitting there, and all the guys around me are just continuing to do their jobs, and we could tell with the amount of fire coming in that this is going to, no one can sit this out. I had never been in a fight before where anybody had to fight wounded. Generally, all our guys, we had enough control of the fight and enough guys on the ground that, the wounded would be able to stop and get treated, and this just really wasn't the case. Everybody kept trying to make an impact. There was lots of guys that fought wounded. And it was when one of the other guys came in and said that he thought that they were throwing hand grenades that I moved to that position to throw some back.
You mentioned that you were shell-shocked, and the loss of blood, I'm sure, wasn't helping with that. Did you pretty much carry on in this shell-shocked or mental fog state, or once you had the tourniquet and maybe an adrenaline flow, you're starting to feel a little more clear? What was
the? I mean, it was shell-shocked for the first few minutes, and then once I got the tourniquet on, and I was able to kind of start to get my bearings, and when, the guys came in and said that they were throwing hand grenades and told me the casualties that we were taking, it started to become clear, I can't sit there. I got to do what everybody else around me is doing, and then getting into it, it almost seems overwhelming for like the first few seconds, but then you just fall into the rhythm of what you got to do, and we had unbelievable leaders and unbelievable training, and really it just all came back to the fundamentals of, this mindset of, okay, what's the next thing that I can do? What are the tools and the resources I have around me? How have I been taught to use them? How do they fit this situation? And then just putting those tools to work.
Did you ever practice ambush situations like that?
Yeah, I mean, a scenario like that, there's certain things you can't train for every eventual, scenario like that, and you can't replicate like that sort of urgency in training, right? Being surrounded, people are legitimately wounded. I mean, if you're in training, you can always say, hey, you know, time out, let's stop, let's talk this through. But I, you know, we had been trained, and it's like a capstone experience, right? It's not like you're trained in one event where you do all these things put together, but you're trained on, we're cross-trained on how to use machine guns. We're cross-trained on medical training. You know, how to, we all knew how to stick each other with IVs, apply tourniquets. You know, there's active training that we do on patrols. Like I had seen one of our squad leaders, you know, teaches guys with a grenade launcher how to arc it and shoot it indirectly to get it into where you can't see, right? And so it's pulling all these things together. I mean, it wasn't just training in the sense of specific skills and tactics, but it's also the way our leaders taught us to think. Always think of, you know, the next thing to do. I mean, that was one of the things about us being paratroopers is they talk about there's LGOPs, right? Little groups of paratroopers. You know, when they jumped into Normandy, these guys were all spread out, but then they just started, you link up with other guys on the ground, you move to the sound of gunfire. And, you know, it's really just a testament to the leaders we had and also just the dedication of everybody around us, because I think we pushed each other that day.
In addition to the grenades, you were also able to send out some suppressing fire, correct?
Mm-hmm.
And what did that consist of, and how long were you able to do that for?
I would use the M240 machine gun, so it was one of two that we had up there, and I would blind fire over the top of the sandbags and come up and try and engage the enemy. And I used that for as long as I could until our platoon leader for our platoon made a run from the vehicle patrol base up to the observation post. It was topside is what we called it, observation post topside. He made a run from the vehicle patrol base with Corporal Jason Hovader, Jonathan Brostrom and Jason Hovader. And once he got there, he took command of the situation. I continued to use the machine gun for a little while, but then, you know, one of the guys that was helping manage the fight, Pruitt Rainey, he was one of the other gun team leaders, and he had been, you know, moving ammo around to whatever anybody needed. He said Lieutenant Brostrom needed the machine gun, so I gave that up and then kind of took over more of a supporting role, like on the radio, talking back and forth with our company commander and just trying to find other ways to make an impact in the fight.
I want to elaborate on that point, because part of the citation for the Medal of Honor also talked about your courage in radioing and continuing those communications, and I think they said within like 10 to 15 feet or yards of the enemy, and so you had to do it in hushed ways and protecting yourself, but it was still vital to getting the support you needed in that situation. Explain how that unfolded.
Yeah, so after Hovader and Brostrom came up to reinforce the OP, you know, they had been there for a little while, and after a certain amount of time, I can't remember how much time, it just sounded quiet. There wasn't a lot of gunfire coming out of the observation post, and so I crawled around. I didn't want to yell out in case the enemy, you know, if I was the only one there, and I crawled around and realized that, you know, everybody was gone. Everybody had been killed or had to fall back. And so it was at that time that I got on the radio and called down and, you know, to the main vehicle patrol base, and they could hear the enemy talking over the radio. You know, and told them that I needed support because I was wounded. I couldn't leave. You know, and they were close. I mean, I was trying to whisper to talk to them.
They could actually hear the enemy over the radio?
Yeah.
Wow. But the enemy couldn't hear you? They never figured out where you were?
No, I mean, a lot of things happen. Again, it came back to just trying to think about more things to do. I called down to one of the other positions that could kind of see the observation post, at least over the top of the sandbags. And, you know, it was always just all of us just trying to think, okay, what's that next thing we could do? And one of my, I knew the guys that were down there. I knew the call signs already down there. And I called down there and had them lay down suppressive fire over the top of my position because I couldn't stand. And my concern was the enemy coming over the top of the sandbags. And so my buddy Brian Hislong down there, a good friend of mine, it was our second tour together. He, you know, wasn't even any sort of response, just immediately started shooting and laying down fire over the top of the sandbags. And then, you know, the guys down at the vehicle patrol base, hearing that I was alone up there and that I was wounded and I couldn't leave, and hearing the enemy, one of the guys, Specialist Jacob Sones, was like, we got to get up there. And he linked up, he and Israel Garcia got together with Sean Samaru and Mike Denton at the same location where Hislong was, and they made a push up to the observation post. So they actually engaged an enemy shooting into the observation post as they were coming up, and those guys came up there and they saved my life. And it wasn't long after they were there, though, that there was another barrage of rocket propelled grenades that came in, and they were all wounded, and Israel Garcia was mortally wounded.
How were you relieved? How did you get evacuated with them once again?
Attacked? Yeah, I mean, we're just trying to treat each other. We're all pretty banged up, and it was just incredible. Is that guys just kept coming, right? They knew what had happened up at the observation post. You know, one wave, Lieutenant Prostrom and Hovader were killed, coming after reinforcing, plus the other guys that had been up there. The next wave of those four guys came up, and Garcia's mortally wounded. They're all wounded. And, at this point in time, the Apaches have shown up on station, and they're starting to engage the enemy. So they're driving them back a little bit. We've had reinforcements, I think, show up from the south. Our first platoon had driven up from another base. And the medevacs are coming in, and they tell us to pop smoke at our location up at the observation post. And we can't get ourselves back because everybody's too hurt. And I remember thinking, we're just popping smoke to mark our location, and never thinking that a medevac is going to come up and land, because we were on a hill. Like, there was this terraced hill, like farming fields, and there's no cover, and medevac bird just comes in and lands right between us and the enemy. And, guys are just pouring up from the vehicle patrol base to come, take care of our casualties and reinforce the observation post. And the medevac crew gets off the medevac helicopter, the crew chief, I think one or two of them, they get off and they start helping casualties onto the medevac helicopter, and they loaded me and Soans, Denton, and Samru up, and that was the end of the fight for me.
Ryan, the thing that strikes me throughout your explanation of this story is, in addition to the amazing story itself, is your recognition of every other guy that was part of this unit, who was there at the time, who was there in all the different waves of reinforcement. And I know that those who are honored, particularly with the Congressional Medal of Honor, often think of the other guys who were there. But I don't often hear it in the way that you did, specifically recognizing each of them by name for each thing that they did. Talk about what those guys meant to you in that unit.
Oh, my God. I mean, we were a family. A lot of us, we spent 2 years together at a minimum and been through a long deployment. We had lost guys before that, and we were a family. I choose the explanation that you don't always like everyone all the time in your family, but you love them, right? And we did. And everything I did, I was just trying to keep up with the guys around me. I mean, they were incredible. And I'm here because of them. I'm here because of those nine guys. Sergio Abad, Jonathan Ayers, Jason Bogar, Jonathan Brostrom, Israel Garcia, Jason Hovader, Matthew Phillips, Pruitt Rainey, and Gunners Willing. And there are so many other guys that, like, I'm the one that got the recognition because I received the award, but like, I know that this isn't mine. I just was trying to follow everybody else around me. All these guys did incredible things. And the only reason I'm here, the only reason I have a wife, the only reason I have kids, the only reason all these other guys have kids is because those guys gave everything they had that day. And, I'll spend a lifetime trying to recognize their accomplishments. And the hard part is, even in like a conversation like this, I can't highlight everybody. Like, this isn't even like 10% of the iceberg that's showing. There were so many other incredible things that people did that day, and they deserve to be recognized for it.
When did you find out, and how did you find out you were going to receive this medal?
Yeah, that's kind of funny. So there's another guy from my unit. He was in first platoon, Kyle White. He received the award about 2 months before me, and we were on that deployment together. His was a separate action, but we had known. I mean, he and I just got out of the Army, and we had gone back and gone to school. I went to the University of New Hampshire. He went to the University of North Carolina. We had kind of moved on with our lives, but we had heard that we had been nominated for the Medal of Honor. And Kyle let me know when he got the call from the president informing him that he was going to receive the award. And so he kind of gave me a heads up, hey, this is coming. And okay. And he actually shot me a text from the Pentagon when he was there on a visit and said, hey, they need your cell phone number. You're going to be getting a call here soon. And that's so really kind of like unofficially how I found out.
So you're tipped off pretty well here.
Yeah. Yeah. That seems probably, not the protocol the military would probably like, but Kyle and I are buddies. And, but the official call came from the president.
And what was that like?
Surreal. I mean, I had never had like any cell phone issues at my house. And then because he was calling my cell phone. And I just sat there, like, praying that my phone wouldn't drop the call, like, just terrified. And I wasn't nervous at all up until, he answered the phone. And we probably talked for 45 seconds. I don't really remember what he said. It was just surreal. it was, yeah.
How about the ceremony?
Ceremony, I mean, again, surreal. I mean, what I really was really important about the ceremony, and I think was pretty amazing, is we, all the Gold Star families were there for the guys. We had most of the guys that were there for the ground fight from my unit, and then we had the Apache gunship pilots and some of the medevac crews there, and you know, it was awesome to be able to have everybody together and, you know, be able to share in the fact that, you know, this is theirs just as much as it is mine.
How long did it take you to recover?
I spent about a year at Walter Reed. You know, a good part of that was just, you know, waiting on the med board process to get out. I spent 30 days inpatient in the hospital. And, but, I mean, they did an incredible job putting me back together. I mean, the medical professionals in the military, just period, because I saw them in Bagram, I saw them in Landstuhl in Germany, and then Walter Reed. And I mean, they've done an incredible job of patching me and all my friends up. And I'm lucky. I'm really lucky.
When did you leave the service?
I left in 2009. Yeah, I got out, went back to school.
And what do you do now?
I work for Raytheon, and I'm a financial analyst.
Ryan, it's an amazing story. You tell it well, and the way you honor your comrades is inspiring as well. Thank you very much for your service. And thank you for your time today.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Ryan Pitts, he's a U.S. Army Airborne veteran of Afghanistan, two tours there, recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Veterans Chronicles.